This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, February 27th, 2008. Sitting in for Aura Bogado in Los Angeles, I'm Tandasizwe Shimaringa. The Supreme Court considers damages from the Exxon Valdez oil spill, a possible coup surfaces in the Philippines, and Colombia's first ever gay and lesbian radio station takes to the airwaves. Those stories and more will be in our newscast, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. The European Union has slapped Microsoft with its largest fine ever for the company's continuing anti-competitive practices. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
In the words of EU Competition Commissioner Neelie Kroes, this $1.4 billion fine is a clear signal to the outside world and especially Microsoft that they should stick to the rules. It's not the first fine and it may well not be the last that the European Commission levies on Microsoft. Back in 2004, the Commission fined the company $750 million because it found Microsoft was abusing its position in the marketplace by refusing to supply the information needed by rivals to design software to work with its operating systems. In 2006, the Commission fined another $422 million for non-compliance with that ruling. Microsoft then attempted to charge a flat $10,000 fee to competitors for access to secret protocols behind its operating system. That was still not good enough for the Commission, who levied today's fine. The European Commission launched two new anti-competition investigations against Microsoft last month. Microsoft claims it will now open up and give access to its secret interoperability information. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan has resumed mediation efforts in Kenya after suspending them yesterday. Annan is calling on both sides to meet with him in person in an attempt to break a stalemate in the negotiations. Opposition leader Raila Odinga has called off demonstrations by his supporters that were scheduled for tomorrow. More than 1,000 Kenyans have died in the 2 months since disputed election results handed President Mwai Kibaki another term in office. Opposition parties in India today forced the adjournment of parliament over the issue of farmer suicides. Bismila Gilani reports.
Both houses of Indian parliament were adjourned minutes after they assembled today as the members of opposition parties disrupted the proceedings over the plight of farmers across the country, seeking to push a discussion on the issue of farmers' suicide onto the top of the agenda. Opposition MPs chanted slogans against what they called the anti-farmer attitude of the government. Opposition members are demanding the government waive outstanding loans to farmers. Tens of thousands of farmers across India have committed suicide in the past decade due to indebtedness. A massive protest on the issue was held outside of parliament yesterday, joined by leftist politicians. The issue of suicide by distressed farmers has returned to the national spotlight ahead of parliamentary elections. Opposition parties say relief packages announced by the government haven't made any significant improvement. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Colombia's FARC guerrillas released four more hostages today to representatives of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. All four were members of Congress at the time of their abduction 6 years ago. They had been reported to be in poor health, but Red Cross workers who accompanied the pickup operation certified they were fit to travel. After a stopover on the Venezuelan side of the border, the former captives will travel to Caracas to reunite with their families. Today marks the second time in as many months that the FARC has released high-profile hostages to President Chavez. A former military officer accused of abducting a pair of twins during Argentina's dirty war has been found dead just days before he was to stand trial. Marie Trigona reports.
The body of retired Lieutenant Colonel Paul Alberto Navon was found on Monday with a gunshot wound to the head in a military hotel in the province of Córdoba. The former military officer was slated to testify next week in a human rights trial into the kidnapping of babies born in clandestine detention centers to women illegally held by the military junta. Police suggest that Navon committed suicide. However, human rights groups suspect that he was murdered to prevent the revelation of further evidence of the military junta India's human rights abuses. This is the second death of a suspect who may have information as to the whereabouts of the estimated 500 babies born to political prisoners during the dictatorship. In December, former Coast Guard officer Hector Febres was found in his jail cell, poisoned by cyanide, before he was to take the stand. Febres was accused of kidnapping babies born in the ESMA Navy Mechanics School, the Argentine junta's largest clandestine detention center. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Nineteen years after the Exxon Valdez tanker spilled 11 million gallons of oil into Alaska's Prince William Sound, the Supreme Court heard arguments about whether or not the company owes $2.5 billion in punitive damages to 32,000 fishermen, Native Alaskans, and others affected by the destruction wrought by the spill. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has more.
The Supreme Court spent much of the 90 minutes devoted to the Exxon Valdez case on the question of whether or not Captain Joe Hazelwood, a relapsed alcoholic in charge of the supertanker when it ran aground, was a managerial agent of Exxon. If he was, that means his decisions on the ship were Exxon's decisions, even though they violated Exxon's stated policies. At the time, he violated Exxon's policy of having at least two officers on the bridge, leaving the steering to a third mate while he went down to his cabin. Hazelwood had been drinking. Jeffrey Fisher, attorney for the victims of the spill, said there were at least 33 documented instances of Exxon employees drinking with Hazelwood or knowing that he drank.
Upper management was aware, as a district judge found, over a three-year span that Captain Hazelwood was drinking and driving supertankers in Prince William Sound. So that awareness and the failure to act in the face of it is what subjects Exxon to large punitive damages.
Still, as Brian O'Neill, attorney for the victims in 1994, stated, Exxon has not accepted accountability at a high level.
After the spill, every white-collar guy at Exxon Corporation got a promotion or a bonus. And the only guy that they fired was Joe Hazelwood.
Exxon has already paid $3.4 billion in fines and compensatory expenses, but the $2.5 billion at stake in this case would be punishment for Exxon's role in the spill and a deterrence for corporate negligence in the future. Ricky Ott, a former Fisher Ma'am, as she calls herself, with a doctorate in oil pollution, says that the $75,000 that will go to each plaintiff is not the point.
What $2.5 billion is going to do is help deter the next oil spill and the one after that and the one after that. It's also going to help bring a little bit of closure to our lives. And it's also going to help us compensate for long-term damages, which this spill, this trial never did. It's only compensated us for short-term damages.
An Alaska fisherman present at the hearing described the economic damage suffered by those who made their living off fishing in the Sound.
Well, typically, say, for the herring season, we might have made $35,000, $40,000. Now, nothing, of course. Nothing for 12, 13 years.
Justices Souter and Kennedy seem to lean in favor of imposing punitive damages on Exxon, but reducing the amount. Exxon argues in their case that the Federal Clean Water Act limits the amount of punitive damages that can be awarded. But as attorney Jeffrey Fisher maintains, the amount is already too small.
When the jury made its award in 1994, it awarded $5 billion in punitive damages. At the time, that was 1 year of Exxon's profits. And so that's where the $5 billion figure comes from. The Court of Appeals cut the figure in half to 2.5, which today is about 3 weeks of Exxon's profits.
Exxon had the most profitable year of any corporation in history last year, breaking its own previous record with annual profits of over $40 billion. Still, Mark Levy of the Transportation Institute, which filed an amicus brief on behalf of a number of trade groups, says that if the court upholds the damages, it could have a disastrous impact on the industry.
It would seriously and adversely affect the maritime industry. It would increase the cost of shipping and make shipping less competitive in relation to other forms of transportation, such as trucking and railroads. It also would have adverse effects on many small companies. There are a number of shipping companies in this industry that, unlike Exxon, are not huge multinational corporations. They may have one or a small number of ships, and to subject them to enormous punitive damages liability could well put them out of business.
Only 8 of the 9 Supreme Court justices are hearing the case, since Justice Samuel Alito recused himself. He reportedly owns hundreds of thousands of dollars in ExxonMobil stock. A 4-4 tie would uphold the lower court's decision to grant the punitive damages. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
The arraignment of a detained opposition senator and 16 military officers for rebellion charges in the Philippines was postponed today amid warnings of a possible coup. According to police intelligence reports, the alleged plot planned to take advantage of growing public unrest over corruption allegations against President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. With anti-government groups continuing to step up their protests to demand Arroyo's resignation, Gurley Lanao in Manila reports that pressure on the military to intervene is also building up.
The Philippines' top security officials have pledged loyalty to President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo as she again battled calls for her resignation over corruption allegations. The officials rejected appeals by politicians and civil society groups for the armed forces to intervene in the political crisis battering Arroyo. They warned that military intervention would only weaken the country's democratic institutions and even trigger a vicious cycle of armed intervention. Despite the show of support for Arroyo, rumors are rife that disgruntled junior officers are planning to defect. A police intelligence report also warned that junior officers were organizing with other groups to overthrow the Arroyo government amid public unrest. Armed Forces Chief General Hermogenes Esperon, however, denied speculation that some soldiers were planning to break the chain of command and support the calls for Arroyo's ouster.
We assure the Filipino nation of our unequivocal allegiance to our flag and constitution, and we give our word not to engage in any partisan political exercise. We, your soldiers, will remain steadfast to our adherence to the chain of command in our pursuit to safeguard democracy, secure our territory and sovereignty, and most of all, our countrymen.
Military and police forces in the Philippines are now on red alert ahead of yet another rally against Arroyo on Friday. Organizers said they expect at least 20,000 demonstrators to join the rally in the financial district of Makati. It will be the third mass protest against Arroyo in the past 2 weeks, since a witness told a Senate inquiry that her husband and a key ally demanded $130 million in kickbacks from a scrap government contract. Arroyo has so far shrugged off the demonstrations, saying her critics were within their rights to protest against her. But she warned that a mass uprising, similar to nonviolent revolts that ousted late dictator Ferdinand Marcos in 1986 and former President Joseph Estrada in 2001, would be condemned by the international community.
The world would instead condemn the Philippines as a country whose political system is hopelessly unstable. Under these circumstances, who would invest in the Philippines?
The military's support was a key factor in the uprisings that ousted Marcos and Estrada. Political analysts said that while Arroyo has continued to enjoy the allegiance of the military, she should be careful because the persistent accusations of corruption and other anomalies against her, her family, and allies were eroding her support base. Bong Mendoza is a political science professor from the University of the Philippines.
Corruption, that is a major issue because these forces want professional, efficient government. And corruption is really a sickness that this group see as one of the major obstacles to national progress. My view here is that the security forces are looking at their interests as a corporate body. And I think what they don't want to happen is them fighting each other. I think what they're trying to do is to maintain unity. That's why they have all of this unity work. And they will see what happens. When numbers are going to be on the street, I think they will know what to do.
Roman Catholic bishops, who also played a key role in the overthrow of past governments, have condemned top-to-bottom corruption in government. But they did not join calls for Arroyo's resignation, giving the embattled leader a breathing space. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Linao in Manila.
Inside the debate hall, Clinton and Obama traded cordial accusations on each other's policy positions. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell takes a look at the public statements and the people advising on the positions.
Clinton and Obama have been trading barbs on health care and trade for a good portion of this campaign. Both issues remained contentious at Tuesday's debate, as both candidates are trying to separate themselves from each other before the next big primary. Clinton says Obama's health care plan leaves out 15 million people, and Obama says Clinton will force people to buy insurance through her government-issued mandate. On trade, Clinton and Obama attempted to portray their history as opponents of NAFTA. Both suggested they would dissolve NAFTA if they're unable to renegotiate with Mexico and Canada. But much of the debate was focused on foreign policy. Clinton attempted to highlight differences between the two by pointing out some of Obama's past statements.
You know, as Senator Obama said, yes, last summer he basically threatened to bomb Pakistan, which I don't think was a particularly wise position to take.
Clinton has not denied that she would take such action, but she has said she would not discuss such options publicly. Here's Obama's response.
If we have actionable intelligence against bin Laden or other key al-Qaeda officials, and Pakistan is unwilling or unable to strike against them, we should.
Host NBC's Tim Russert asked what each would do if the U.S. leaves Iraq and al-Qaeda emerges. Clinton dodged the question.
You know, Tim, you ask a lot of hypotheticals, and I believe that
this is reality.
Well, it isn't reality. You're making lots of different hypothetical assessments.
Now, I always reserve the right for the president, as commander in chief. I will always reserve the right to make sure that we are looking out for American interests. And if al-Qaeda is forming a base in Iraq, then we will have to act in a way that secures the American homeland and our interests abroad. So that is true, I think, not just in Iraq, but that's true in other places. That's part of my argument with respect to Pakistan.
As much of this debate was focused on foreign policy, both Clinton and Obama have dozens of paid and unpaid advisors directing their positions. Many of Clinton's are former members of her husband's administration, including former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Samuel Berger, former National Security Advisor. Many of her advisors, with exceptions like Albright, supported the war in Iraq. One of her top advisors, former Clinton UN Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, was an advocate of the war until 2005. Holbrooke has been criticized for his role during the Carter administration, where he advocated for Indonesian military head Suharto's repression of the people of East Timor and supported Philippines dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Some say Holbrooke is a likely candidate for Clinton's Secretary of State. In Obama's camp, he too has many former Clinton advisors, many of whom opposed the Iraq War. One is Dr. Susan Rice, former Deputy Secretary of State of African Affairs. He also calls upon human rights scholar Samantha Power. But also advising Obama is General Merrill Peak, who was also a key player in the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, and also advised George Bush in his 2004 re-election bid. Another advisor is Dennis Ross. He has been the main architect of the Israeli-Palestinian framework for the past 12 years. Although it's hard to predict the moves of a president, Stephen Zunis, politics and international studies professor at the University of San Francisco, says Obama tends to surround himself with people of varying ideologies. Yet Zunis hesitates to predict any radical change from either candidate.
I don't think you can expect any changes in terms of how they see the U.S. role in the world. I think there is this assumption of American global leadership or hegemony, if you prefer, a certain belief that that the United States unilaterally can set the terms regarding such issues as international law and the use of force and the like.
The candidates will continue their campaigning primarily in Ohio and Texas until those states, along with Vermont and Rhode Island, vote or caucus on March 4th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org.
The size of U.S. terrorist watch lists is now in excess of 900,000 names, an absurd proportion according to the American Civil Liberties Union. Today, the group unveiled its new ACLU watch list counter to make vivid just how bloated and dysfunctional those lists have become. The new counter features a rolling odometer-style display with a real-time readout showing how many individuals are on the list at a given moment. The watch lists are used for a growing array of purposes, most notably for subjecting domestic airline passengers to additional screening and often far more intense law enforcement scrutiny, selecting individuals for scrutiny and interrogation at the nation's borders, and for excluding people from the country entirely. Jay Stanley is a spokesperson for the ACLU. He's also the public education director for the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project, which designed the watch list counter.
The agency that maintains the list, which is the National Counterterrorism Center, gets names from different agencies which send them to them. And other than that, we don't know much. And one of the problems here is that if you find that your name is on this list because you're stopped at the airport or at the nation's border, or you find that your bank won't do business with you anymore, that you have no way of finding out why you're on the list, what you're purported to have done, and it's very, very difficult to get off the list. So what we have here is a situation where these watch lists facilities, these watch list institutions are being created willy-nilly with very little thought being given to innocent people, to due process, and to, you know, and to sorting out people who are truly guilty from others.
That was Jay Stanley of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Project. The ACLU watch list counter is viewable online at www.aclu.org/watchlist. Radio Diversia, Colombia's first ever station for the lesbian, gay, and bisexual community, began broadcasting earlier this month in Bogota. The station, which is run by 15 journalists and volunteers, has been received enthusiastically by the local gay community. Manuel Rueda has more from Bogota.
It's Friday night in Bogota, and Radio Diversia is on its fifth day on the air. In a small studio, the on-air DJ is taking calls from a listening audience made up of mostly men. The callers request songs, talk about their plans for the night, and occasionally flirt with the host. For some, this is plain fun, while for others, it represents a risk or a unique opportunity to show feelings that they may not want to express in person. Indeed, some callers do not want their voices to go on air and speak to the DJ on the internal line. It's the type of program that director and founder Carlos Serrano has been looking for.
Our idea is to promote our way of life, our rights, our inclusion and not exclusion. That is what Radio Diversia is supposed to do.
Diversia is the only station in Colombia and one of the few places in Latin America that exclusively addresses the needs of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities. Although Diversia has 20 staff volunteers and features an active web presence, there's no funding for transmission equipment. The studio was donated by a local NGO, and regulations for purchasing a broadcasting license are complex. So the station is limited to internet broadcasts. Despite these obstacles, its page gets over 2,000 hits per day, and dozens call from different parts of the country every day. The beeps you hear are the listeners, sending messages over the station's chat room. Diversia's daily programming includes 6 hours of talk shows and programs in which the topics range from sexual health issues, relationships, and other more practical topics like legal issues facing the LGBT community. Francisco Castro is the station's other director, and he hopes that Diversia will also have an impact on the larger population.
We want to show that we are regular human beings, that we are not sick or degenerate, or deformed at birth, nothing like that. We simply have a different sexual orientation.
But stereotypes are not the only problem that Radio Diversia faces. Marcela Sanchez, the director of the Diverse Colombia Foundation, says that discrimination against sexual minorities is still rife.
We are still getting cases of students who are expelled from their schools for having lesbian or gay relationships. There are homosexuals who are still not adequately treated in hospitals, and we're getting many cases of police harassment.
Sanchez says that laws against discrimination exist, but that they are often overlooked. This is also true for homosexual political leaders who face intimidation from right-wing groups. Gay rights leader Freddy Spinetta was assassinated earlier this month, and several of his colleagues are currently in exile. But Sanchez also says that despite these problems, the LGBT community is finding ways to move forward, and that Radio Diversia is part of an important trend.
I think that the gay community is becoming more and more visible, and it needs more places to meet, like cafes, discos, and bookshops. People want more information. They want to find those that are like them, who share similar interests.
For the moment, Colombia's LGBT community will have to go online to find its radio station. But Radio Diversia is already expanding. Its directors are contacting gay bars like this one for sponsorship, and they're already setting up correspondents in other cities around Colombia. The directors hope that in the long run, they will be able to go on FM. Manuel Reda, FSRN, Bogotá.
A Montana court is currently considering sending a top Bush administration official to jail for violating federal environmental laws. The standoff began in 2006 after a small nonprofit organization in Oregon won a lawsuit against the Forest Service for its refusal to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act. Now, after years of continued noncompliance, a federal judge has found the U.S. Undersecretary of Agriculture, Mark Wray, in contempt of court. FSRN Saeed Banura has more from Oregon.
In his 7 years as the top official overseeing the U.S. Forest Service, Mark Wray has been severely criticized by environmentalists for his interpretation of federal policy to allow more logging on public land. Now, for the first time, Wray faces possible jail time for his ambivalence toward federal environmental laws. The lawsuit against the Forest Service involves the agency's practice of using up to 40 million gallons a year of toxic fire retardants to fight fires on public land. The National Environmental Policy Act requires studies on the effects of the fire retardant, but these studies have never been done. Scott Greason is the director of EPIC, a Northern California-based environmental group.
The Forest Service has probably the most developed infrastructure of fire suppression in the world. The Forest Service is now spending literally half of its budget on fire suppression. They just assert that fires are bad, and so anything they do fighting fires must be good, even if it has some bad effects. The Forest Service, unlike every other federal agency that fights fire, and many do, has refused to follow the National Environmental Policy Act.
In 2006, U.S. District Judge Donald W. Molloy gave the Forest Service 18 months to follow the law after the agency lost a lawsuit brought by the Oregon-based group Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics. Andy Stahl is the director of the group.
The deadline was October 15th of last year, and the dispute right now concerns whether Mark Wray, in fact, fully complied by that deadline. And we assert he has not. The judge happens to also believe that Mark Wray has not complied. The court laid out the three alternatives. The first is incarceration. The second is house arrest subject to electronic monitoring for Mr. Wray. And the third is to enjoin the use of fire retardant. It would be a timeout from using it until the Forest Service brings itself into compliance with the law and has done the necessary studies.
A decision on the case is expected sometime late tonight or tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Saeed Banura reporting from KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Jackson Allers. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Technical production team is Puck Lowe and Antonio Ortiz. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tandisizwe Shimarinka.